Okay, the first question is, when interceding for someone who has mental illness mixed with possible oppression, besides staying in the state of grace and obedience to one's state in life, what is the most efficacious thing to do? Yes. So when interceding for someone who has mental illness mixed with possible oppression, besides staying in the state of grace and being obedient to state in life, what is the most efficacious thing to do? The most efficacious thing to do is to, at least that I've found, is to pray to Our Lady of Sorrows, specifically under that title, and ask her to reveal to you what is the source of the person's problems or difficulties, either to reveal it to you or to the other person, so that once you know precisely what the problem is, then you can tailor the prayer specifically for that. If you discover it's diabolic, then there's certain things you can do to get rid of them. If it's something that's there's some area of their spiritual life that needs shoring up, you can start praying specifically for them for that virtue. You can develop that more of that virtue on your own, offering that up for that person so that they are able to overcome the particular difficulties. Sometimes with mental illness, if it's something that's organic or natural, that is, it's something in the brain or something like that, you may just be stuck with it, and the person has to learn to adapt and develop the virtues in relationship to what they're suffering. Can you speak on generational wounds? How does this occur, and how are they healed? Can your parents' vices, issues leave you with spirits to battle? The common opinion of exorcists is yes, it can. There's a couple of exorcists who say, no, I don't believe in any of that. But my experience has been very consistent, that basically what spiritual wounds are is if they're from a generational spirit, there's basically what happens is somebody in the family lineage, usually one of the fathers in the family lineage, commits a serious sin. The demon gets introduced into the family lineage, and then from there he picks at the people, and it can be passed. And as a result of that, when people kind of give in to the picking, it gets passed from generation to generation. And sometimes these can go on for quite some time. It doesn't affect everybody in the generational line. Sometimes there's some people that seem to be exempt from it. It doesn't. The nature of the demon doesn't always pick according to his nature. So he may, like, it could be a demon of pride, but he'll drive issues of chastity in the family, you know, contrary to chastity. So those can actually happen. The demons can also, once they get their foot in the door, can drive people to commit sins that cause psychological and other wounds to people, to their family members, to the children, and things like that. Then what happens is the demon can get their foot in the door into that person's life through that process. And then the demon can pick at the woundedness and drive the person to do those same things, ironically. So it can be passed generationally in that way. Sometimes he just gets into a person's life and drives them to do other things that just cause damage in other people's lives. The vices of parents are twofold. One, they can open up the door for demons getting in and affecting people, but they can also be just a thing that kids learn. Let me give you an example. If every time somebody gets, if one of the parents gets annoyed, they just blow their stack, what you're basically teaching the kid, now the kid doesn't think to himself, oh, when this happens, I blow my stack. He's not thinking that. It's just part of our brain structure is automatically designed that when this happens, I associate this behavior so that when the time comes, all that is brought up, and so the person will get the inclination to do those very same things. So the person, I call it implicit learning. The kid can just learn the behavior from the parents. So that can happen. But not always. Sometimes parents have hidden vices, like vices against chastity, and the next thing you know, some 9-year-old kid who's, they're living, externally that things seem to be chaste, but the father, say for example, is doing really bad things, like watching pornography on the internet or something like that, or engaging in really bizarre activities, the next thing you know, this kid is having that identical ideation from no external cause whatsoever. It's clearly diabolic. And so this is one of the reasons why it has to be. So how do you heal from that? Well, if it's psychological trauma and wounds, then you can listen to my conferences on wounds and healing. I kind of lay out this is what a wound is and this is how you heal from it. If it's a generational spirit, I highly recommend, again, you pray to Our Lady of Sorrows and ask her to reveal to you what is the generational spirit that's in your family. My personal experience in dealing with people is that virtually every family has one. And so this is why each family has kind of these eccentricities or quirks very often. And so if you can find out what, if you pray to Our Lady of Sorrows, what is it that's our family? Because a lot of times what you see isn't the problem. So for example, in one family where chastity was kind of an issue and also kind of a lot of quarreling went on in the family, the demon was actually a demon of fear that was driving it. So once the family discovered that, they were able to start working against that and things started to subside. So this is one of the things that you just kind of keep in mind. Ask Our Lady to pray with Our Lady of Sorrows what it is. Then once you know what it is, then you can do things like binding prayers, asking for protection, etc., or maybe even have a priest pray over your family to drive the thing out. To have you as a spiritual director, what do you have to do? Okay, so 30 to 40 minutes of prayer a day. But then the other thing is stop venially sinning. Stop it. I don't know if every if you want to watch a funny video, go on YouTube. And there's a video, just type in Bob Newhart, stop it, right? And it's this woman who's doing these compulsive things, and the angel just tells her to stop it, right? Just stop it, right? Well, that's the way it is with sin. You have to just stop it. And that means, though, that you're gonna have to start doing other things. You have to make the choice, I'm going to just remove these sins from my life. I'm going to stop them. In fact, most people are recidivists. Now, a recidivist is someone who repents, or goes to confession, but really has no intention of amending their life. And how do you know that? Well, most people go to confession and they'll confess venial sins, and each week it's the same thing over and over and over and over again. What that tells you is that even though they don't like the sins, they don't really have a purpose of amendment. If they really had a purpose of amendment, they'd think to themselves, I got to get this thing out. I'm going to take the means. I'm going to go ask Father, what do I got to do to get this thing out of my life? But they don't. That's why Teresa of Avila says, look, if you just removed one vice a year or one sin a year out of your life, in a few years, you'd be practically sinless. But most people just don't do that. And that's because most people are spiritually slothful. So you have to remove the stop venially sinning. Part of the reason I put that as the criteria, because then I know they've reached probably the end of the passive or the active purgation. And so it's at that point where the spiritual life starts to become dark, and that's when they need the direction. Before then, they normally don't need the direction. And if they have some type of grave sin they're overcoming, then they just need advice once in a while, just not consistently. Is to take pain medicine for physical pain to reject the suffering we are sent? It depends on why you're taking it. If you're taking it because you like the way you feel from those drugs, that's a bit of a problem. But if you're taking it so that it can take the edge off of it so that you can fulfill other duties of your state in life, then there's nothing wrong with that. Also, sometimes the pain that people end up receiving on a physical level, especially towards, like, say, those later stages of cancer, certain kinds of cancer, can be excruciating. And the person, if the person has a certain level of virtue, they may be able to tolerate that in relationship to morally and not take the pain medication. But some people get so severe that basically they may have to take it. Sometimes, too, you can take it even in those particular cases, even if you did have the virtue, if it's the type of thing that taking the pain medication would take the edge off it so that you would have a greater ability to function so that you could pray more or do certain things rather than just sit there in a kind of a painful stupor, so to speak. So I'm not saying that you should never take it. On the other hand, I'm a little nervous with people who, you know, the minute they get a hangnail, they're running for the medicine cabinet. Right, there should be a certain willingness to suffer to some degree, and the only time you take it is when it's starting to impede your ability to do some of the higher virtues like prayer and things like that, or fulfill your duty as your state in life. What do you do if no priest wants to be your spiritual director? Maybe you need some self-examination. No, I'm just kidding. How important is it important to have one? In the initial stages, it's not that important. You just have to come to basic knowledge of the spiritual life, which you can gain either through the internet or from paying attention to the homilies, and start putting that stuff into practice. That is, lead an ordinary life of grace, going to the sacraments, regularly, praying regularly, working on your vices, etc., doing spiritual reading. Once you reach a certain stage, as I mentioned, it's important that you get one. What do you do if you can't find one? Well, finding a good director is getting more and more difficult. Teresa of Avila used to say that if you have a choice between a holy priest as a spiritual director and a knowledgeable one, take the knowledgeable one. And the reason being is because the knowledgeable one is going to know how the mechanics of the spiritual life work, and she says that he's less likely to give you bad advice. She said she had numerous holy spiritual directors who gave her very bad advice, and it didn't work out very well. Because just because you're holy doesn't mean that you have the knowledge necessary. Okay, so what you need to do is find a priest who actually understands the spiritual life fairly well. And people say, well, how do I know that? Go to confession. He listened to his preaching and go to confession. The advice you get in confession will tell you whether he's going to be a good director or not. And if there's nobody in the area, then you just have to start praying to Our Lady to provide you with somebody at some point. And she'll make sure that at that time that you'll get it. Is the genesis of suffering privation? Actually, that's the genesis of all evil. All evil is the result of a privation of a good that should be there. That's a privation of a due good. What does it mean by privation? There's something not there that's supposed to be there. So, take for example, fornication. The reason fornication is wrong is because there's the privation of the bond of marriage. That's why it's evil. Murder, the privation is that there's the lack of something penal in the person that's being put to death. So, in other words, they're innocent. So that's why murder is immoral. So there's something lacking that's supposed to be there. So in suffering, what's happening is that there's something that's not there, whether it's the right order of our faculties, and so as a result we were experiencing pain. It couldn't just be the lack of physical health that's caused, and as a result we have physical pain as a result. So there's always something lacking. Meditation. I was taught to meditate by a New Ager. However, I meditate by prayerfully asking Jesus to help me quiet my mind so that I can hear his directions. Am I doing it right? That's one way of doing it. What I recommend that people do is you can get, I think it's even on the internet somewhere, there's about an 8-page layout by St. Francis de Sales on how to meditate. It's the shortest, best synopsis, one of the best, if you're looking for something short, that's the best synopsis. So you can type in the internet, St. Francis de Sales, methods of meditation or whatever. If you want a greater understanding of how to meditate, the book, The Ways of Mental Prayer by Lahoti, that's spelled Lehodey. It's put out by Tan. It's the best book on meditation I've found anywhere, because it goes into all the do's and don'ts, the structures, the different forms of meditation, how you actually engage in the meditation, its structure, the mechanics, etc. So it's a bit of a dry reading, but when you get done with it, you'll know what you're doing. The Ways of Mental Prayer. The Ways of Mental Prayer by Lehodey, Lehodey. Last I saw, Tan now has all their books on Amazon, if you want to go through Amazon. But you can also order it from them directly. To what degree does one take physical mortification? It depends on what you mean by take physical mortification. To engage in things that are physically unpleasant and difficult has to fall under right reason, which means you engage in them to the degree that's necessary in order to develop the virtue. If there's something that's just going to impede, for example, your fulfilling of your duties in your state in life, you don't just sit there and take the physical mortification, you try and get rid of the thing. This is an important point, by the way. There are certain crosses in a person's life. There are two kinds. There are permanent crosses that God wants you to carry for the rest of your life, basically. Then there are temporary crosses that Christ wants you to carry for the time that's necessary to develop the virtue. Now, those temporary crosses are of two kinds. One is the ones that Christ sends you and you don't have much control over it, so you just have to endure it for as long as he decides it's going to be there. But there are certain crises that actually come from a diabolic cause, And those are the kinds that you don't carry for any more long than you have to. Your job is to get rid of the guy out of your life. Because sometimes people, for example, who are possessed or under diabolic influence, well, this is just the cross of Christ. Excuse me. No, you're in spiritual battle here. Your job is to whip this guy. Okay. Will you talk about the virtue of silence and what that virtue looks like in the lives of people in the world, especially mothers who have to interact with people so often? Well, let me preface it by saying this. Through modern brain studies, what they've discovered is that the speech center in a woman's brain is three times the size of a man's. What they've discovered is that women get 10 times the amount of pleasure drugs in their brain from talking than men do. Okay, now, people say, well, that's not good. Actually, it is good. When it's done moderately, what does that mean? The reason that God put that in a woman's brain is because of the fact that they've discovered through modern brain studies and through psychology, that if you don't talk consistently to children under the age of 5, over the course of time, it will cause physical brain damage. That God actually put that in a woman. It's a perfection that she put in her so that she will talk frequently and readily to the children to develop the speech in their centers in their own brains, etc. Okay. But that means, though, however, it's for your children, not your husband, okay, or other people. So it means it has to be moderated. And that virtue that moderates is the virtue of silence. And the virtue of silence means that you speak no more or no less than is necessary given the circumstances. So with your children, you speak with them regularly, etc. But when you're not, then you generally, the tendency should speak only when necessary. That's the general thing. Now, some saints will say that you have to stand before God and account for every syllable you speak. That's true in the sense that, not that if you talk a little bit too much that it's necessarily sinful, but it's not developing virtue. And so it's an imperfection. And so concretely, that basically means that, you know, when you get on the phone, you know, you basically, you know, if you need to arrange because it's the soccer game is tomorrow, well, then you call and say, what time is the soccer game? Where is that? Okay, thank you very much. And then you get off the phone. You don't sit there and spend 45 minutes talking about how bad the coach is. Okay. Hopefully there's nobody here coaching soccer. If the devil has dominion over the earth, isn't the one sending us all our suffering? Isn't he the one sending us all our suffering, like concentration camps, when things are horrific? Then God sends us grace to and overcome them. God gives us grace to overcome. Does God give us grace to overcome evil? Okay. First, it's true that the devil is involved in a lot of the evil that is in the world, but not all. Some evil comes to us as a result of human beings' choices. Now, the demons might be, you know, encourage them to do so, but some of them come from that. Some evils come from the hand of God in this sense. He will retract from, say, a person or a group of people or a nation, a particular grace or benefit in order to chastise them or to gain greater virtue in them. This is what's coming down the pike. He's winding up to whop us. And the fact is that he's going to do it by retracting the benefits that we have, such as a good economy, plentiful foods, things like that. He's just going to retract it. Because all good, he has to be the cause of it. So that means that he can just retract it. So not all suffering comes directly from the devil. A lot of it does, but not all of it. Okay. Do you have any advice on how we can raise our children so that they have less fear of suffering? For example, I have heard some people argue that parents should not rely over much on punishments because they can inflame in our children a fear of suffering. Well, there's two parts to that question I want to address. The first is, Dr. Spock does not trump God. Okay, now Dr. Spock came out with this idea, and very other people did, came out with this guy that you should never use corporal punishment for your children. The problem is that especially under the age of five, children don't have the use of reason. So trying to reason with them is ridiculous. When you hear these parents, the kid's 2 years old, Johnny, don't you see the suffering you're causing, Jane? Why do you do that? The person who needs to be slapped is the parent. All right. The kid, Aristotle made a profound observation very early on. He said, children under the age of reason learn by associating pain with bad behavior. Now that means though, however, that that has to be moderated in relationship to the punishment. It should be no worse than, you know, if the kid just, says something a little bit out of place, you don't take him and whip him to death, right? I mean, that's just not, it's just disproportionate. So it should be proportionate to the crime, and it should be no more, no less than the nature of the crime and the degree of the crime, okay? The second side of it is that in the scripture it says, spare the rod and hate your child. People who do not use corporal punishment in their children, in the end, don't form their children properly, and as a result, they don't understand that there's certainly moral right and wrong. One of the things that they're discovering is, I find this very fascinating. There's a psychologist that I work with who's done some initial research, and she's found that in relationship to people who have disaffective disorder, which is the inability to have emotionally connect with people, etc., and also these kids that are going in and mowing people down with AK-47s and stuff, like in schools and stuff, they have one thing in common. They went to daycares. Now, I'm not saying that the daycares are the cause of it. What I'm suggesting is this. First of all, you take a kid, there's 20 other kids there, then there's two people trying to take care of it, which means that there's not that tactility, and the reason that God gave women a stronger emotional life is so that they can empathize with the child, to bond that and make that spiritual or emotional connection so that we have a sense of right and wrong in relationship to other people. But what happens is we take the kid, we put him in a daycare, the thing is traumatized, basically, in the end, because of the fact that it's in this situation that's kind of brutal, because it's getting beat around by the other kids, there's nobody comforting the thing, etc. And so as a result of this, the kid ends up with these disorders, right? What does this mean? It means that the foundation for the moral formation of a child is before the age of reason. You have to associate pain with evil and reward with the good. But that means you have to have both. You can't just punish the kid all the time whenever he does something wrong and never reward him when he does something right, because then he never gets a sense of motivation to do what's right. Okay. So, does it inflame a fear of suffering? Yes, if it's disordered, it will. But the fear of suffering is there from original sin. Every kid is going to have it de facto from original sin. There's nothing you can do about it, as far as them getting it. All you can do, though, is teach them that, you know, sometimes when you do things that are difficult, you get a good payoff. There's a good reward in the end. Let me give you kind of an example. I use this example in relationship to God and why God allows demons in our life. You know, sometimes when a father, you know, he's got this 4-year-old boy, and he really likes his 4-year-old boy, and he wants him to kind of tough him up a little bit because he just wants him to be a fine young man. So he takes him to a boxing ring, and he puts those great big gloves on. You know, the ones that are so big the kid can hardly even hold them up, right? And he puts him in a boxing ring with another kid. It might be a little bit bigger, right? And he says, okay, when you go in there, this is what you do. And he gives him a little coaching, and he says, you know, when he goes, keep your hands up, and you fight, when he says, you hit him right. Now, the reason he does that is so that the kid can take a little bit of a beating in the process, right? And the reason he allows a kid to take a little bit of a beating in the process is because he wants the child to learn that, look, I can take a bit of a beating and I'm okay at the end of it. The suffering isn't going to kill me. I don't have to avoid it. And at the same time, if he does it right, he might take the other kid out, and then he realizes the reward, that sometimes to get the thing that is good, you have to be willing to suffer and engage in things that are painful and difficult to get there. So even when kids are small, having them do little things that might be difficult, but then rewarding them when they achieve it, they begin to realize, hey, I can do this. I can get a sense of, you know, I can suffer and it's okay. It's not going to kill me. And so, and sometimes in the end, they're willing to kind of do those things. So the next thing you know, the kid's like, Dad, can we go back to the boxing ring? You know, so obviously you don't want him in there too long because you don't want all the concussion issues that they get. All right. Would you give recommendations on how to discipline children considering their temperament, such as a choleric child? This is what I suggest you do. Buy my book on psychology. Because in there I talk about all the temperaments and how each temperament has to be motivated. And so there's some basics in there that you can read. By what principles should someone determine good children's literature? There are essentially two principles. The first is, as long as they don't teach anything contrary to Catholic teaching. So if there's anything in there contrary to Catholic teaching, you have to avoid it. Second, is it the type of literature that will benefit my specific child on an intellectual or on a developmental level? So it's not just, you know, will it help him to read better, or will it help him to do it? It's also, is it contrary to that? Sometimes the good literature, too, is the ones that can do both, where they can engender a sense of morally right and wrong, etc., or the pursuit of virtues, or, you know, sometimes, I think, you know, one of the great things about the Lord of the Rings trilogy, or a lot of Tolkien's works, is how engaging in the battle and the suffering, in the end, the triumph occurs, and so that's why we always have to fight evil when we come across it, to the degree that we can. How best would a wife respond to a husband who does not lead spiritually? Well, when you get married, in the past, they used to give a woman a rolling pin. And I'd say, just beat him over the head with a rolling pin. No. One of the things I would do is, I don't want to do this self-promotion, but I don't know of anywhere else to send them. You know, one of the things you might do is have them listen to my conference on how to raise a man, because in there I talk about how, you know, it's the husband's role to lead and that he has to be willing to suffer in order to be able to do that. And that it's his job, it's his responsibility primarily to lead the family, since he's the head of the household, not just on a material or natural level, but even on a spiritual level. The other thing I would do with the wife is you have to start praying and suffering and giving, and so that he receives the grace. I'm offering up so that he receives the grace to start leading spiritually. And the next one is, you have to be willing to suffer this a little bit. Start saying binding prayers on any demon that's keeping him from rising to what he's supposed to be in relationship to that. A lot of times you start doing that, his head will clear a little bit and he'll stop being so worldly. Okay. Is acupuncture okay? Well, first let me ask, the second question is Pilates okay? My understanding from other exorcists, I haven't delved into the Pilates stuff too in depth, but they all pretty much say, no, you have to avoid it across the board. And I'm not sure why, because I haven't gotten any detailed information yet about it, but they all say, no, stay away from it. As for acupuncture, there's two kinds of acupuncture. There's one of the things is that they have discovered through scientific studies that acupuncture does actually have a foundation in scientifically in being able to ameliorate pain or have certain effects. They've been able to track the physiological effects, so they know the physical causation. So on a purely scientific level, it's okay. So I basically say then if you're going to have acupuncture, you need to make sure you know your practitioner. The practitioner has to be completely separated from the Eastern practices that go along with that. For example, that this affects your chi and it affects, the chakras and all that nonsense. You have to avoid that like the plague, because it's through that that the people can become diabolically influenced through acupuncture. However, if they're doing it purely from a scientific point of view and it's purely done like a physician, I know a good Catholic physician who does it and he's completely divorced it from all of that. Then what happens is that it can actually help people in that respect. Okay. How does someone determine if they should seek professional counseling? If someone should seek counseling, then what should he or she look for in a counselor? There's two parts to it. One is that you determine that your problem isn't a spiritual problem. If it's a spiritual problem, because some of our psychological difficulties are the result of a spiritual problem, then you need to really see a good, solid priest first And then if that doesn't clear it up, then you can go see a professional counselor. If you've determined that the problem is a strictly psychological problem, that's when you want to basically see a counselor. What you want to look for in a counselor is two things. One is that they're Catholic, and by Catholic I mean not in name and not in their own practice, but in the way they counsel people. It should be integrated into the counseling and not just some, I'm a Catholic counselor, but then you get there and it's all Freudian, right? It shouldn't be that. The second thing is I highly recommend you look for someone who implements a Thomistic approach to it. In other words, they follow the principles and understanding of how we function psychologically from the way St. Thomas understood it. Because those are the guys that tend to have the highest degree of success. Okay. How would you advise introducing virtue to children at the initial emergence of reason? Or even things to emphasize in early childhood when impulses and emotions are not mediated by reason? Okay. The way you have to do that is, children before the age of reason cannot develop virtue. And the reason they cannot develop virtue, St. Thomas says, is because virtue is voluntary. You have to have free will in order to do it. Children don't exactly have free will before the age of reason, because in order to make the choice, as I mentioned last night, you have to have use of reason. Reason has to present the will, its object, and they don't have that fully yet. So what you have to do is you have to, again, make these associations. They are trainable. As one woman who's a wife of a psychologist, she said, look, basically before the age of reason, your kid is an ape. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. So basically what you have to do is the same way you would train an ape. All right? Not exactly, obviously. But the point is that you have to do that association with pain with bad things and pleasure with good things, or reward with good things. But part of the other thing is that, children, even before the age of reason, are not that stupid. In other words, what you can do is you can teach them, if you keep doing this way, it gets easier. And then as you do it and it gets easier, then it's less difficult to obey mommy or things like that. In other words, get them into the habit of seeing that if they do something repeatedly, they get a better outcome and it becomes easier. So that's kind of the initial stage. And then as they start getting, once they kind of get into the habit of that, and then you train them to be temperate, like don't eat the cookie. Look, if you get into the habit of turning away from the cookie jar, it'll get easier, right? Just keep doing it, right? So you can kind of keep encouraging them to do the same thing. And that's basically reinforcing the association that they actually have, so that when reason begins to kick in, then you can start talking to them about the individual virtues. Like, well, temperance is what we do when, we get into the habit, or we just repeatedly turn away from the candy. I mean, it doesn't mean from time to time we don't do it, but we just turn away from the candy so that it gets easier to do that, and you start engendering that in the children. And you also reward virtuous behavior, basically. Okay. What if we observe the suffering of a person on a long-term basis? For example, audiovisual harassment of a timid and disadvantaged person by a type of bully. Do we stand by and say nothing? Well, first thing is we have to be willing to suffer what that person is going through as well, just as Our Lady accepted the suffering of her son. So interiorly, there should be a certain level of attachment and willing to embrace that suffering if that's what, However, on the external level, we may have to intervene in order sometimes we may have to do something. I mean, physically remove the person from the situation that is causing the problems or the damage. As far as saying something, there is the general principles of fraternal correction, which basically means one of the primary principles is, in saying something, will the person who's doing something bad take the correction? If they won't, you don't say anything. Because, as St. Thomas says, if you say something and it makes the situation worse, you become culpable for making it worse. Whereas if they'll take the correction, then you have an obligation to say something. So you have to be willing to suffer it. You also have to be willing to suffer the fact that you're probably going to get chaffed at from correcting people. But it should be governed by a reasonable judgment of whether the person will take the correction. When I suffer or a family member suffers, I pray for God to help by removing the suffering. This, I guess, is wrong because I'm impeding the development of virtue for myself and for my relative or friend. Instead, should I be praying specifically for strength to deal with the suffering? Yes, what you should be praying for is asking Christ for the grace to accept the cross for as long as he chooses for you to accept it, and to gain the virtue out of it and the purification out of it, or the merit for other people out of it that he wants you to gain. Is saying the rosary enough for meditation? Well, the rosary is meditative, but it's not meditation as such. In other words, you're still doing the vocal prayers, you're saying something vocally. So in that level, it's a combination of meditation and vocal prayer. But meditation, the average person should, I think, the average layman should be doing at least 15 minutes of meditation a day, which means you put everything else aside and you just pick an object of meditation, like our Lord's mercy or his profession, his goodness, his piety, which means how good he takes care of us, and focus on that and how it applies to your life, etc. So it should be, and that should just be that straight meditation. How do you know if something is a duty versus an area of pride that you like? Can you be too exact? Okay, let's ask the first part of the question. How do you know if something is a duty rather than an area of pride? Well, you have to first look at your state in life. What's your state in life? Are you a married woman? Well, then, you should keep a good house. I mean, things should be, generally speaking, try and keep it clean. Try and keep it well appointed, suitably decorated, etc. But the area of pride, how do you know there's pride in it? If in looking at the thing, it's self-referential. And by that I mean that, you know, when you do it well, you feel good about yourself, and that you look at that thing and make you think that you're better than you actually are. Okay. Sometimes pride will, you know, people will say, well, you know, I have this talent. Yeah, you do. You know, everybody thinks, well, I got to find out what my talent is. Well, I'm sorry, but there are certain people who just don't have a lot of them, or none in some cases. I mean, maybe what God wants them to do is just to develop the virtue of humility. So, and I think that it doesn't mean that God doesn't give us individual perfections, etc., but it just means that a lot of times people tend to take pride in what they think they're good at, when in point in fact they're not that good at it. In other words, maybe one of the things to do, and this is one of the things I suggest, is start, if you're worried that it might be an area of pride, is start asking your guardian angel to humiliate you and ask him to show you that this, whether this is an area of pride or not. Ask Our Lady to reveal it through grace, to give you that grace to see it. Start saying the litany of humility with the express intention of asking God for the grace to see whether this is an area of pride or not. Because generally speaking, pride is very blinding, and we can't really see it without grace, as a general rule. Can you be too exact? Yes and no. No, in the sense of, as far as your own interior life, submitting to your job and what you should at that moment do. So you can't be too exact in that regard. However, sometimes you get people who are claiming that they're being exact according to their state in life, and all they're doing is driving everybody out of their tree. And by that I mean, for example, the duty of the state in life is, there's a kind of a lack of priorities. Your primary duty is to the spiritual well-being of your husband or wife and your children, then to their material upkeep. And so sometimes people will say, well, my duty is to pray for my children so that they never take care of the household. Or they'll basically, the wife thinks, well, my job is to keep up the household and make sure the children learn how to do this stuff. And so they're standing there with a stick beating the children to make sure that they're taking care of the dishes, right? So in other words, it can go to excess in the way in which it's done, not as to the interior disposition of dying to always doing it when it's necessary. What does meditation look like for a mom of many children? It looks ugly. All right. Sorry. Okay. It basically means that you have to try and find some manner in which either you get up early or you go to bed late, in which, or you just, if your kids are old enough, you say, I'm not available for the next 15 minutes, and you go in your room, close door, and put the earplugs in and hope the house doesn't burn down. But you basically have to start segmenting out of time. This is one of the reasons why a regimen is helpful. I realize that in a big family, a regimen is exceedingly difficult. But sometimes if people can get into some kind of a regimen, because the regimen helps us develop that virtue easily. So basically it just means if you have a lot of little children, it just means that you're going to have to probably get up a little earlier before the children do. Or when the children are all taking their naps or preoccupied, then you take a little bit of time and do the meditation. Sometimes you have to sneak the meditation in at various times, but it's really a development of getting into the habit of being able to do that when you have that opportunity. What about duties versus duties of state versus meditation? Basically, if you look at our obligations, it's to God, then to our own self spiritually, then our children and our husband and children, our wife and children spiritually, and then materially it breaks down from there. But our duties, basically our primary duty is to God. So this means that if a person uses their duties or their state in life as an excuse not to pray at all during the course of the day, they are failing their primary duty. Now, our normal obligations in relationship to God are fulfilled by fulfilling our duties in relationship to other people. So it may be if you have a lot of children that your duties or your state in life are going to take up, that is, taking care of the family, taking care of the children is going to burn up a bulk of the day. So you're not going to get the luxury of spending an hour in prayer and meditation and spiritual reading. You're probably just not going to get that. But it doesn't mean you don't do any meditation or you don't do any kind of praying. You need to make sure that you're getting that time, trying to segment out the time or rearranging the schedule a little bit. And sometimes too, you know, Johnny doesn't have to go to that fifth kind of activity. Let's just cut it back to two so that Johnny still gets to engage in those kinds of activities, but that it frees up more time in relationship to the family. My sister used to have this practice, which I thought was actually a good one. She would tell her children, you get one extracurricular activity which will require obligations on my side, and that's it. Because otherwise, you get this thing where, you know, basically the woman's a chauffeur in the end. She's just taking kids from one thing to another. And she's not, and the kids aren't meditating, the people aren't meditating, etc. The other thing is, too, is if you're teaching your kids to pray regularly, you're going to be getting your prayer in. If you teach them to meditate, you can start meditate when they meditate, too. What about sleep? I highly recommend it. All right. It depends largely on the individual. Virtue is a mean, moral virtues are a mean relative to the individual, which means what? That they're somewhere in the middle between excess and defect, but where that middle line is depends on the particular individual. So for example, a guy who's 6'4 and works a hard job on construction, for example, is going to eat a lot more food and still be temperate than, say, the guy who just, you know, he's 5'3 and has a desk job and he just clicks buttons, okay, because the bodily demands are going to be more. The same thing is actually true in relationship to sleep. I know a priest, he can go 6 hours without, or he can get 4 hours of sleep a night and he's perfectly fine, right? Other people, if they don't get their 7 or 8 hours of sleep, they're a bit of a mess, right? So as far as cutting back on the sleep, you just have to make sure, is the cutting back on the sleep detracting from my virtue? Is it making it much more difficult or significantly more difficult to teach, to treat the children well or my husband well or my wife well or what have you, if it's detracting from that? If it's not, if you can cut out about 15 minutes of sleep or get up 15 minutes early to do your meditation, then you should do so. But it's your body will tell you. And how you react will tell you whether you're cutting too much back on the sleep. And the same thing applies to fasting. If you're fasting too much, your body will let you know. So, okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yes. Binding prayers are basically if you have authority over the person, you can command the demon to be bound so that they don't perform, to engage in a certain kind of activity. If you don't have authority over them, you can ask Christ or Our Lady to bind them so that they can't do certain things. So, yes?
Follow-up question about the foundation of pre-virtue for young children.
Yeah. Yes.
Displacing the proper motivation, right? Because virtue isn't just about the frequency of behavior, but also about the interior motivation. But it's more about that transition from early childhood to adulthood, and your thoughts about the moderation of the use of rewards. Displace the motivation you're trying to get.
Yeah, that is actually very true. My father one time said to me, he said, children, especially boys, have to be raised a little lean. And by that he means this. He means it doesn't mean you don't reward them and you don't compliment them at certain times. But it shouldn't be every single time they get it, because then what happens is the reward becomes the compensation for actually performing the action rather than the actual doing of the action itself. The interior motivation comes from essentially two sources. One is that there's a moderated use of rewards and punishment to some degree, but also not giving the reward all the time. In other words, people have to be recognized that sometimes I have to do a lot of stuff to get this thing that I need to achieve. They did a study, I don't know if you saw it, they did a study, I don't know how you do a formal study of all this, but they did a study of billionaires. And they asked them, what's your greatest fear? And they said, across the board, like 80% of them said, my greatest fear is that my children have no motivation. Okay, where does motivation come from? Motivation comes from something that's lacking in you that you need, and that you recognize that you need, and the knowledge that if I perform specific things, I can attain that thing that I need. That's where it comes from. If every time I need something, it's just handed to me, there I'm never going to take the action necessary to achieve the thing. This is why you have to give some types of rewards and you have to give motivation. Now, how does that come? Well, one of the ways is that I often recommend to people is that when kids reach a certain age, you tell them, look, your job is to go mow the lawn. And if you mow the lawn, I'll give you a buck, right? So then the kid gets motivation to earn the dollar, right? And outside of that, you don't give him any money. So that he has to begin the process of realizing that I, as a man, have to attain this on my own, and I can't just expect an entitlement program from the government to give it to me, right? So there has to be a recognition that, but sometimes also, you just have to tell them, go do this. Am I getting paid for it? No, you're not. You're just going to go do it because it's the right thing to do. So that they recognize that, for example, in marriage, there's certain obligations you just have to fulfill that you're not going to get rewarded for. You're not going to get anything for it because it's just your duty. But that the actual doing of itself and becoming a good person, the process, is the reward. And so that's why it really boils down to the moderation of the rewards. But it's also the same thing in moderations of punishments. It's right in Scripture, where it says, fathers, don't nag your children lest they lose heart. In other words, every time the kid does something wrong, you don't beat him, you know, or harangue him or demean him or whatever the case is. What you do is you do it in a moderated way in times in which, you know, he might think to himself, well, can I get away with this? Well, every so often when he doesn't get away with it, he's going to realize, you know, this just isn't worth it. But if you're constantly after him, then what's going to happen is the kid's going to think, I can't do anything right. And so that's what has to be avoided. Okay. Someone over here had a question. Hand up. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the authority is... Yeah, so what are the limits of the authority? What are the boundaries and who you have authority over? It's pretty straightforward. It depends upon primarily what's called an office. So, for example, a husband as because of his office of husband, has authority over his wife because of the fact that he is her head. The wife doesn't have authority over her husband in the spiritual sense, but she does have authority over his body. Now, what does that mean? When you get married, I mentioned this, I think marriage is an exchange of bodily rights in which you give rights of your body over to the other person. So she can do binding prayers for you based upon that right. She can, the husband and the wife as mother has the office over her children, so she can do binding prayers over her children. It is the common consensus, and it seems to bear out in my own experience, that you have, once your children are adopted, before then you don't, but before that, once they're adopted, you have dominion over them or authority over them, and so as a result, you can bind them. The jury is out about grandparents because it's once removed and the parents have the direct right and the grandparents don't necessarily. The general consensus is that they don't. Siblings, do they have authority over each other? Not unless it's delegated by the parents. However, it seems to be the one case where people can say binding prayers for their other siblings and they don't get retaliated against. So, and kids, and for the same reason, can kind of do it for the parents. We think that it basically comes from the obligations of the fourth commandment. We think that's why they're protected. So, but outside of that context, they don't necessarily have authority. Superiors in a religious order have it over the people, bishops over their priests, etc. Priests can say binding prayers for anybody because they have spiritual authority over all people by virtue of their priesthood. And so you just have to kind of look to make sure that you have that authority. The only exceptions, as I mentioned, are children and siblings. For some reason or another, we think it's kind of the fourth commandment, but they have the ability to say the binding prayers and still be spiritually protected. If you start saying binding prayers for people you don't have authority over, you're going to get taken to the woodshed. Yeah. Oops. Yeah, technically speaking, praying in someone's name. Okay, yeah. The question is what about praying for in someone's name? Does that give you the authority over it? Technically, no. To say praying in someone's name just technically means you're praying for that person or for that person's intentions. That's technically, theologically, what it means. The idea of praying in someone's name is actually, I have yet to find any person who promotes that idea. I have yet to find anybody who can give me an adequate theological foundation for it in the church's traditional teaching. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't be praying for somebody, or if someone says, would you pray for so-and-so, or would you pray in my name for X, for me, actually all they're doing is asking you to pray for them, technically. So the only time that I can see that that would have some kind of force is when a bishop or a priest is delegated to do a specific set of prayers for a specific intention. But that's because of the nature of the priesthood, things can be delegated, and so the priest, for example, every time he does exorcism work, is actually praying in the name of the bishop. But it doesn't work for lay people. That's my understanding of it theologically. That doesn't mean that somebody says, would you pray in my name for X? Yeah, you can pray for the person in those particular things. Sorry, I didn't mean to burst any bubbles. Yeah. No. No, the godparents actually don't have the same authority that we've experienced. By the way, this is based largely on experience. We've kind of narrowed it down to authority is based on office and it's based on civil. The reason we've discovered that is because we have had people who are godparents saying binding prayers, commanding binding prayers for their godchildren, and then they get retaliated against significantly. So we're not, so it doesn't seem to give them any authority. The obligation to correct them in relationship to their Catholic faith doesn't seem to give them sufficient authority. That's just our experience. Yes? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's always, it can be. in the sense of the, for example, when a bishop gives faculties to a priest to do exorcism work, it's based on certain conditions. He can say, for example, he can say, you have faculties to do exorcisms over this person, so you have the authority, until such time as the person is liberated or you cease working with them. So if you cease working with them and then 10 months later they come back, you have to get faculties again.
I guess what I was thinking more in the acts of someone, the gay
authority. I'm sorry, one more time.
In the acts of someone, the gay authority. In other words, you have...
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes.
Why?
Yes.
I said authority is conditioned based on the person, acts of the person, whether they're... That's what I was saying.
Yeah, I would probably put it a little bit differently. What you're saying is true, but it's a little bit differently. There's a distinction between having the authority or a power and the right to use that power. So, for example, when you're ordained, most people do not understand this at all. When you're ordained a priest, you have the power of the priesthood. You do not have the right to make use of it at all. You have the power, you don't have the right to make use of it. The only time you have the right to make use of it is when the church concedes you the right to make use of it. So, if I don't have the right, it's called faculties, if I don't have the right to hear confession, even though I have the power to absolve sins of my priesthood, I don't have, in this particular case, that lack of right actually negates it, and your confession's invalid, right? So this is a very key point. In marriage, the husband has authority over the father, the husband has authority over the mother and the wife. However, that authority, if he abuses the authority, only during the time in that his right to make use of that authority becomes suspended. Now, there's a moral principle called abuse does not take away use. What that means is, if he abuses his wife, in a certain sense, like, for example, if he's abusive and says, I don't want you going to Mass anymore, I don't want you doing this, or what have you, she doesn't have to submit in relationship to those things for which he's being abusive or abusing. However, in relationship to the stuff that he's making legitimate use of, she still has to submit. So it's the same thing in relationship to authority. Just because an authority gets abusive in one area doesn't mean you can completely write them off. It's the same thing, for example, if a magisterial member says something contrary to the faith, it doesn't mean that you can completely dismiss that individual's authority. It just means that in that particular area, you just ignore him when he's teaching something contrary to the faith. But outside of that, you still have the obligations to follow it. Does that make sense? It's just a different way to say the same thing, but it's based more on how the church used to make those distinctions. Okay, we'll stop there.